It's my pleasure to introduce this morning's keynote speaker, Rear Admiral Tim Ziemer. As all of you, I think, are well aware, Admiral Ziemer leads the President's Malaria Initiative. President's Malaria Initiative is a major U.S. government undertaking, a major new public health investment to help control malaria in Africa. Its goal is to reduce malaria deaths by 50% in 15 countries. It rivals PEPFAR, if not in scope, certainly in the potential impact and its importance for Africa and globally. In a previous lifetime, Admiral Ziemer was a naval aviator. He held a number of important command and senior staff assignments. And in his varied career, Admiral Ziemer was also executive director of World Relief, which provides humanitarian and development assistance in more than 30 countries. So we are indeed very privileged to have Admiral Ziemer with us this morning. He's agreed to provide concluding remarks for our conference and to answer a few questions afterwards. Admiral?
Thank you.
Welcome.
Good morning, everybody. It's my unenviable task to get you out of here by noon and still say something profound and give you some food for thought. But I'm up to it, and I hope you are. Hang on to your hats, because I'm going to take my prepared remarks and kind of mush them together to try to get to a couple points. First of all, to the speakers in the panel, CSIS, for putting this together. I think it's really key, as you listen to the presentations, to see what great work is being done across the world in many different forums. And I think we ought to all be encouraged by that. In today's audience, I just want to acknowledge a couple people. Michael Miller from HHS used to be over at PMI at USAID. I give him credit for being part of the initial concept, restructuring of how USAID does malaria prevention and getting it off. And then he handed it off to me, so I had the easy job of getting it cranked up, scaled up, and moving. Richard Walden is here from USAID. He works in the Global Health Department. Richard, it's good to see you. Dr. Sammy Denny Jones, a good traveler, but also a key component working with us in HHS. Again, as I listen, I think it's very important to just pause, take a deep breath, and say thank you all. You at this level of putting together forums like this, but the practitioners in the field working very, very hard and diligently to do something about the problems at hand, and then those of you who represent the interagency process. Colonel Hebner, I didn't mean to ignore you. I saw you over there. An indirect partner and beneficiary of some of our funding, but not enough. I know he says that. I've been asked to do a couple quick things, and I'm going to be real quick here because I want to get into a few minutes of Q&A at the end and still get you out of here. What is PMI? How do we scale up? What's the strategy? Is it working? Why is it working? And what are some of the components that might be helpful in the context of what we discussed today? And secondly, the good news is with the massive reauthorization of PEPFAR, tucked in underneath there, if you haven't read it, is a huge recognition and funding for malaria and also TB. Let's not lose sight. And I was really glad for the closing components here, or remarks in the last segment, that malaria kind of trickled up, and I don't think it was because they knew I was coming, and TB kind of trickled up. I think collectively, from an interagency process, and then as partners, we have to look at the entire field. And then I want to just comment on a couple things, because the DOD interagency partnership issue is really part of the homework that we have today. What is the role in PMI? Is there a role in PMI? And then what is the appropriate role? I think those are important questions, a little bit higher level than what we were talking about just a few minutes ago. I think everyone in this room would admit that humanitarian interventions, be they public health, community development, disaster response, are inherently complex, whether they be good programs, whether it be just practical implementation of work or on a moral level. Why do we do what it is that we do? Programmatically, it's just getting the job done. Practically, who does it? Who does it better than us? And then morally, why do we even do it in the first place? Those are all questions that we got to keep asking ourselves as we stay busy trying to do what it is we're doing. When you add the budget process, and then when you add the reality of cash flow, like my fiscal year 08 programs, not counting the early money that Congress and OMB gave me to get my keep my project going, the 08 money is just now beginning to flow. And the United States government does a pretty good job as compared to our other major funder, the Global Fund and the World Bank. So when you add the budget realities and the actual cash flow, and then you bring in all the interested partners together, it can get pretty challenging in order to get done these life-saving initiatives that we're all so committed to and passionate about. The real subject today is partnership. How do we do it together better? And if you sit back and really analyze partnership, you have several scenarios. You have us all at the racetrack, lots of music, trumpeting, racehorses, thoroughbreds. We're all going to partner together in that event, but by golly, we're in it for ourselves. Then there's another picture of a cow in a pasture with a bird on the back and a farmer. The farmer is waiting for the cow to be fed for its slaughter. The bird is content eating ticks. Okay? They're partnering. They're together, living together, but are they all doing the same thing? My analogy that I like to tell my staff is we're just two ugly, lean oxen yoked together, pulling together, not for our own good, but we got a farmer that doesn't necessarily speak our language, but we're all working towards the same goal. As we partner together in this very complex world, we've got to make sure that we understand what it is we're partnering for and why we're doing it in the first place. When you examine, though, what has been accomplished over the last few years, both at the PEPFAR level and at PMI, I think we all get pretty high marks. There's been very careful, deliberate planning and implementation at every level. The costs have been high, but over the past 5 years, the United States has really done quite an extraordinary job in global leadership in addressing HIV and AIDS and the malaria endemic. And we've used the one government platform. PEPFAR country teams have demonstrated a commitment to the highest standards in implementing over $18 billion of taxpayers' investment, supporting 2 million people on treatment, over 7 million infections prevented, and 10 million in cure. In PMI, in the first year, in three countries, we had 6 million beneficiaries, and the second year, with only 7 of the 15 countries online, 25 million beneficiaries. So these are really unprecedented results that have really changed our methods. It's changed how we think. It's changed how we engaged with our partners. But because of the work that we have done and the progress that we have seen, we enjoy strong bipartisan support by our Congress and this administration in this commitment to invest such a significant amount of money in what we're doing. As I looked over the objectives for this forum this morning, there are a couple things that popped into my mind. What is it? Why is it that our government is comfortable investing the treasury in what we do? I think the real question is, how long will our government have the appetite and the ability to do what we want to do? And I would say it simply boils down to two possible facts. Impact. Are we showing the results of this interagency work and effectiveness? And are we, as part of government leadership, coming together in the most efficient way so that we can make every dollar count? I don't know if you've read the Lancet article that was in a magazine just recently, but it was interesting because they put foreign policy into several categories, metaphors. Let me just throw them out for you. Global health is foreign policy. Global health is security. Global health is charity. Global health as investment. Global health is public health. So, DOD, where do you fit into that lineup? USAID, PEPFAR, where do we fit into that? You partners, what is your motivation in being a partner with the U.S. government as we look and do what it is we do? Coming from the military, the question I keep wanting to ask is, what is the overarching strategy? What links what you do, all this great work that we heard this morning by the presenters, what links that fantastic work with the overarching national strategy of the United States? When I was at the Joint Staff doing op plans for places we were doing work, we always had to answer the question, how does this activity link in with the national interests? And if it was fuzzy, then we had to try to clarify it. I would suggest those of us on the health side need to ask that question quite often. How is what it is we're doing as we put our hand up and say, as an interagency partner, we want to do, we must do this? How do we link national strategy with national military strategy with State Department and foreign assistance? Why is that important? Real simple. And this is really how we run PMI. We've got to stay focused on the objectives. We've got to be able to resolve distractions, and there are many. We've got to set up a common standard, M&E, show impact, and then we need to know when we've got to change directions or quit. I'm already out of time, and I'm only just getting started. I'm not going to get into the reason for PMI, but in 2005, this administration was confronted and had already embraced HIV as a international problem. But when the administration realized that 300 to 500 million people a year were infected by malaria, that 1 million died mostly in Africa, and today 3,000 kids were going to die of a known preventable curable disease, that was unconscionable. So President Bush, prior to the G8, as part of an announceable, but more importantly, to demonstrate our commitment to Africa and public health, said, I'm in for $1.2 billion over 4 years. We had proven strategies. We committed to 15 countries. I won't tell you what the criteria was for selection. We targeted two of the most vulnerable groups, kids under five, pregnant women. Using the cash in the 15 countries, looked at a scheme to come up with an 80% coverage with two prevention strategies, IRS and NETS, and then two treatment strategies using the best antimalarial drugs, ACTs, and the combinations thereof, and working towards addressing the pregnant women through the prenatal clinics with sulfur dioxide paramethamine, which is an intermittent therapy. That was the target. We had the cash. We had the plan. And the other important component of this is, as we developed the plan, it wasn't our plan. Our engagement was based and predicated on the three ones. Is there a national plan at the country? Yes. Then embrace that. Follow the national leadership, and then look for a basic standard of M&E and impact. We committed to that. The PMI rolled in, consulted with the countries, with our specific goals and targets as limitations, and then looked at the other funding partners. What's the Global Fund bringing to the fight? What's the RBM guy, World Bank bringing to the fight? What's Gates bringing to the fight? Okay. So the entry point, for those of you who are interested in hearing the magic word, where do we engage and how do we engage? It's at the national level, very much modeled after PEPFAR. We're looking at helping build capacity over time by building the national plan and then our engagement will be there to sustain, build capacity to carry out the National Malaria Control Plan. I'm jumping around, and I apologize. How are we doing? In addition to the coverage rates, which are pretty impressive for a startup initiative, let me just throw out two or three. In Tanzania, in a district where we've been spraying, indoor residual spraying, we're seeing a 37% reduction in positive blood smears from the same hospital during peak seasons from last year to this year. There's been a 70% drop in anemia in that hospital, attributed partially to the indoor residual spraying. In Malawi, in the six districts where we've been working primarily through the distribution of bed nets, we're seeing a 43% drop in severe anemia kids between 6 and 30 months. Zanzibar, you probably heard the success story there. Combining with the funding from the Global Fund and PMI with nets and spraying, we've seen a reduction of 90%, going from 23% of the kids going into the clinics to less than 1% of those children testing positive. Okay, and the good news is the malaria indicator surveys are saying that 74% of the kids are now sleeping under the nets and 73% of the pregnant women are using nets. Now, the real question is, if those trends are true, and we'll continue to validate that, how do we sustain those programs? And we all just are committed to capacity building and sustainment. Okay. What are our critics saying about PMI? Senator Coburn, you probably know him. He took USAID to the cleaners a couple years ago. That's an understatement. Michael was on the receiving end of some of his recommendations. But the good news is under Secretary Administrator Natsios, there were some internal changes made within USAID. As a result, PMI was able to move, achieve these specific goals, and given some funding consideration so that we could get up and running. If you were to read a Lancet article about a year ago, you'd see that Lancet gives us a pass. This is the U.S. government's anti-malaria program, known as PMI, now in its second year of implementation, is avoiding many of the pitfalls in some of the other foreign assistance programs. I consider that a good press release. And then AEF coming it's Africa Fighting Malaria, rates USAID and the U.S. government malaria program as the best as compared to our other G8 counterpoints. We got a B+. The closest was the Brits at C-, and everyone else was D- or below. Those are indicators, not to pat ourselves on the back, but to say that the mechanics and the format, in fact, of how we're implementing is been fairly significant. How are we working with DOD across the spectrum? But frankly, it's mostly indirect. We're aware of the research labs in the three countries in Africa. We do invest, not enough, but a significant amount continually in vaccine research. We have two entomologists assigned to our support staff, one in Mali, one in Atlanta, working with CDC. And so there are the ingredients of effective partnerships developing and taking root. The real question, though, is how do we engage at the DOD level, at the AFRICOM level, on a program that is really focused on the National Malaria Control Plan? And again, since I'm running out of time, and we can pick this up afterwards, but the real engagement point for any interagency partner would be at the country level, where most of the planning is done and then brought up and worked through at the interagency working group level and then approved up through the chain of command. I'm going to quit right there. I had some other examples of soft power, hard power. When you look at the AFRICOM strategic requirements, it really begs the question about categories of engagement. Hard power and soft power. This health business that we're all fortunate to be working in falls into the soft power. I think it's even tougher to manage and to integrate at the interagency level than hard power. Hard power, we kind of go alone. But the interagency process is much more difficult because there are different motives for engagement. Looking over each other's shoulder to see who's in charge, who really calls the shot, how much money is coming, and how do we get our money to do whatever it is we need to do. So the soft power piece, particularly as AFRICOM comes up and online, is a very difficult component of bringing things together and trying to be effective and accountable to the U.S. taxpayers' dollars. I'm sorry for rushing, but I want to get you out of here by noon. I hope that's been helpful. We have a lot more to pass on to you informally.
Thank you very much, Admiral. That was extremely interesting, and I hope you didn't feel too rushed. I'm sure there will be some questions here, maybe a little opportunity for us to have some discussion in the remaining time. Let me ask for questions. See any? Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Hi, I'm David Hendrick with the CSIS Africa program. Sir, I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the role of China and malaria in Africa. How is the U.S. considering their contributions? Are you working directly with them? And if not, why not?
Yeah, that's a real good question, and it's a real key one. And actually, Michael Miller has a lot more insight on that than I do. But let me just step back. Our malaria folks, as our HIV folks, are engaged at the WHO, Global Fund Board, and the RBM board level. And so the engagement of China must be at that level and also at Global Fund. They are not present at the RBM board. They should be. Now, they should be because they have a malaria problem. They're also interested in Africa, and that's where our primary focus is, although we do have two regional programs. They do drugs. They produce drugs, sorry. And some of the drugs are great, and some of the drugs haven't passed the WHO test. One of our biggest concerns in PMI is safe, effective drugs. When someone is just about ready to die of malaria and you give them a bad drug or an ineffective drug, it's not going to help them. He'll probably die. If you have another disease and you get a bad drug, you might have a day or two for the doctors to sort it out. But drug safety and drug effectiveness are huge problems. And when the Chinese companies contribute foreign assistance in kind, like in the Comoros Islands, like in some of our other countries, and I won't name them right now, without having passed the good housekeeping seal of approval that Dr. Margaret Chan has put down, then that's a big concern. So we must be engaged with the Chinese government. But as you know, there are different challenges from a marketing and from a political perspective. So at this point, we, the U.S. government, put a recommendation on the board, the RBM board, to extend an invitation to the government of China to be present at the RBM board meeting to work on procurement issues, drug issues, and then hopefully they can become a donor country and work together with us as we look at serving other countries together in Africa. Yes, ma'am.
Hi, I'm Kelly Moss with the Congressional Research Service, and I just wondered how PMI works with the NTD initiative.
Yeah. PMI is a USAID-led initiative. Okay, that's different than PEPFAR. PEPFAR statutorily has its own governance and accountability standards. PMI is unique, and I credit Michael Miller with this, in putting it underneath an existing agency with a strong burden and supporting requirement from the interagency guys, HHS, primarily CDC. Now, since we're housed in USAID, there are benefits of that in terms of the legal and the environmental and the compliance and the procurement stuff, but more importantly, resident right next to us. And in fact, many of our team members work in other components, maternal child health, child survival, avian flu, neglected tropical diseases. So our managers, our technical resources, our resident co-share, continue to look at ways we can leverage the funding to achieve specific objectives, but avoid redundancy and leverage funding so that we are looking at standardizing procurement systems, diagnosis, things like that. So I would say the model affords us an opportunity to pull us together and look at ways of leverage. Does that help? Sammy. I should say Dr. Jones.
Thanks. Some of us have come to know that I think your appointment has recently been changed. You've been nominated by the President Bush to be, I think, coordinator of all U.S. government malaria activities. What does that mean for you, and what does that mean for PMI?
Two things. If you look in the authorization, the next presidential malaria coordinator or U.S. government global coordinator will be a political appointee, okay, working underneath USAID with defined parameters. In terms of my job description, it's virtually the same, but the decision to make it official has now been facilitated by the new legislation. So I'll get a piece of paper saying I'm a political appointee, but nothing has changed. Now, in the future, if, in fact, competing priorities against our budget allow Congress to fund PMI up to $1 billion a year, the funding comes with some language on how to direct the funding and who's the partner or who should be the partner, okay? Actually, it reflects the current processes and methods that we have today in general. I would say that's a good thing because what it does is it clearly defines who has 51% of the vote, who he or she is responsible to up the chain of command, and it just removes some of the fuzziness that exists in other interagency programs because the funding is all clear coming in through one source. So it really puts the burden and the responsibility on the next malaria coordinator to get it right, to make sure that the interagency process is functional, effective, and we're achieving our goals.
And congratulations on the accomplishments with PMI. I really appreciated your metaphor around hard power and soft power and would like to hear just a bit more for those of us actively engaged in the interagency process for PEPFAR and similar programs, what guidance or suggestions you have about how to most effectively work within the soft power dynamics to achieve these.
Yeah, do we have time for that?
Well,
blame him. That's a difficult discussion, and I have a lot of opinions. Hard power is easy to define. Okay? We're going there. We have this many people, these many allies, this much gas. There's the bridge. We either figure out if we're going to secure it or we're going to blow it up. Okay? That's pretty easy. It is carrying out the political will or the political interests of the country. So when I use the hard power words, it's really to, and maybe it's because I'm coming, my mind is still military in its thinking, it really clarifies what I'm doing, where I'm going, and when I know I'm done and when I can go home and go on liberty. Soft power is much more difficult because the world reflects soft power. Disease, famine, terrorism. And the truth is, what the Department of Defense has been doing in some of the most complex places has forced the issue of appropriate engagement. Where's the line in terms of mission accomplishment and mission engagement? And how do we unionize that, or should we unionize it? When I came in the military, boy, those union lines were really clear. It's called Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marine Corps. We knew what fraternity we were in. didn't necessarily mean we could talk to each other in the same airplanes because they had different airplanes. The point is Congress at that point recognized the military needed to work together and forced it through legislation that the services needed to integrate more effectively. They accomplished that because of national political leadership and Congress. I don't think it would have happened quite as soon as quite as efficiently had it not been mandated, okay? But that's still defining the hard power box. We all still did military stuff. To take all of the interagency partners with the expectations of the American people, with declining dollars that are discretionary for us to do all the work that must be done in the world today, mandates a clear direction from the top, strong leadership to understand it and to implement it, and then tell us all where we're going, soft or hard, but particularly in the soft power environment. The military is very good and very comfortable doing soft power in disaster responses. We all celebrate the work that was done with UNSN Mercy after Aceh. 4,000 volunteers from the public health sector, from volunteers in the hospital, and the military got together, and 96,000 beneficiaries later, the ship sailed. 62% of the folks from Aceh had a favorable opinion of the American people when the ship pulled out. 6 months later, because I was working there with World Relief, I went up to Northern Point just to have a moment of inspiration, and I ate in this little restaurant, and on the wall was a picture of the USNS Mercy. And I asked the owner of the restaurant, "What is that?" He said, "Oh, that's an American ship." I said, "What, why is that up there?" He said, "They came and helped us. They helped us very much. We wish they were still here. In fact, we like them better than our military." That's soft power all day long. The military does soft power excellently in disaster responses because of the organization, because of the logistics capacity, and there's one guy in charge, and they all know what they're going to do. Okay? When the military gets involved in the traditional HHS, CDC research, working the programs in the field, and look at the complex requirements of community development, both at the government side, USAID, and also the NGO side, it's a different ballgame altogether. That's the soft power. Building stuff, preserving it, building capacity so that we can alleviate poverty, so that we can see famine averted. Okay, I'll go on and on. I get pretty passionate about that. But does that help at all? It's much more difficult to do soft power than hard power.
Admiral Zimmer has been been at pains to try to make sure we keep to our schedule. So maybe we'll take one more. Maybe we'll take one more question if we have one.
Maybe it's time for lunch.
Maybe it's time for lunch. Yeah. Maybe all the
questions
have been answered.
Colonel.
Admiral, I certainly enjoyed your remarks on Malaya. I wondered if I could ask you a leading question. You talked about the end game, which is eradication of these diseases, of the state of health that's not just seen in terms of public health, but global health, economic stability, growth, the full realization of people's potential. Mm-hmm. Given that the major diseases of mankind, smallpox, yellow fever, have been tamed by vaccines, what do you see as the necessary effort for HIV, tuberculosis, and malaria vaccine development? And are those portfolios being looked at across the board, across the government, as potential solutions, as a toolbox for the follow-on to the important work that you're doing now?
Yeah, Colonel, you being in the medical field really need to answer that question. I'm a generalist. I used to fly airplanes. But let me tell you how I approached the answer to that question. When the word elimination or eradication came up, everybody in my shop grabbed their throat, fell over on the floor, and started kicking their feet. And they said, "Don't you dare ever use the word eradication, elimination, ever, because it's impossible." So I was trained. I didn't use it. I said other things. Then we went out to the Gates Malaria Forum, and this very well-respected man stood up and in front of the entire world said, we're going to shoot for elimination. And everybody looked around and said, can't believe he said that. The point is, I think he gets it. If you've got to have a goal, and you got to understand that time is flexible in this case. And as we shoot for the future, it's people like you in the research world that we have got to acknowledge and continue to fund, because at the end of the day, if the E word is implemented, it's going to be because of the excellence in research and drug development. Meanwhile, there are those of us in the trenches that are trying to figure out how to get nets to people, how to get people to use the nets, how to get houses sprayed if it's the right strategy, how to get anti-malarial. So at this point, at the UN General Assembly on Thursday, the Gates-funded Global Malaria Report, underneath the umbrella of the RBM board, will be released. I'm anxious to look at it. In theory, that should start shaping a strategy for the future. We still need to recognize the key elements of policy and leadership. On the health side, WHO, but on the implementation side, there are really three basic funders, four: U.S. government, Global Fund, the bank, and Gates. Okay. Now, the UN Foundation and other foundations, Malaria No More, come in doing different things. But we've got to have the plan, we've got to look at the funding, and then the strategy to look at reducing the footprint, trying to reduce by 50% malaria morbidity and mortality, because that's not the United States government's goals, that's the UN Millennium Development Goals. What can we do now before 2010 and 2011 to bring that unconscionable infection and death rate down to something like this? Then, as we continue to invest in vaccines and new medications and new strategies, how do we close the gap so that one day we can control it? Let's pray for elimination, but let's not get too distracted about the E word. Does that help? But the key, the ace in the hole, at the end of the day, it's what the research companies are doing that's going to actually help us reduce this, where we can say, whew, we've made a little progress here.
I've gone on too long. Thank you. No, thank you. Thank you very much. It was really an ideal conclusion to our conference this morning, and I want to particularly thank you for that overarching conceptual framework into which we can, I think, fit a number of our activities and reflect on them and evaluate them. So thank you, sir, for an excellent presentation. And thank you all again for your presence today. We've enjoyed staging this event. We hope it will not be the last of its kind, and I have a signal from the back of the room to fill out the evaluation forms. Is that what you wanted me to say? Please, if you do have those evaluation forms that you picked up, check those boxes and drop them off on your way out. Thank you again.